everyone. On the third day of this Walking the Ancient Way session, I'm always happy to see the third day. You know that a lot of the heavy lifting has been done. The mind is quieter, more concentrated, spacious. Call it sometimes a meditation retreat, but my first teacher, John Dido Lurie, used to call it a meditation intensive, looking deeply into the nature of our own minds, looking deeply into the nature of reality, with the intention to realize for ourselves our own essence of mind. I often imagine to myself the mind as a pool of water in a forest clearing. It's a common analogy, particularly in the Theravadin tradition. Come to Sesshin to look deeply into that pool of water and see all the way to the bottom, which is what this work of uncovering our true nature, our Buddha nature, is. To see all the way to the bottom and realize the essence of our lives. What is it that's alive? What is it that's aware? We say these words over and over again, but that's really the root question. What is it that's aware? It takes a lot of courage, a lot of fortitude, a lot of stamina to sit sesshin and face your own mind, to sit with the frustration of a mind that seemingly can't find rest, to face all of our stuff that comes bubbling up, all of the physical challenges, all of the emotional challenges. In truth, the mind is still an open like space, boundless. Everything arises within it. But sometimes in our lives, sometimes on the cushion, it seems anything but still and open. More like a monkey on meth, maybe. When we come to sesshin, our minds are more like a roiled up pool of water, muddy and agitated. And what is it that roils them up? Fear, anger, envy, depression, feelings of worthlessness, agitation, dissatisfaction, all of the negative emotions of our lives, all of these negative emotions that cloud the mind and manifest in unwholesome actions in our lives. The poet Mary Oliver says that each of our lives is like a flower, as common as a field daisy and as singular. And from our ordinary everyday perspective, though, these negative emotions are like a worm that gnaws at the heart of this flower, gnaws at the heart of our lives. There's a lovely poem by William Blake that speaks to this. William Blake, the great British mystic. O rose, thou art sick, the invisible worm that flies in the night, in the howling storm, has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy. This mind, in sesshin, can seem like a howling storm sometimes. But in sesshin, with patience, with diligence, the mind quietens down. In the Tao, it says, do you have patience to wait till your mud settles and the water is clear? Seen from the perspective of I, me, and mind, these emotions are nothing but the response to the events of our life, not lining up from how I want them to be, not lining up with my mental picture of what's in my best interest. I'm in here, in this body, and I need to get the circumstances of my life out here lined up the way that'll make me happy. But when we take the backward step, and the thinking mind becomes still, we take the backward step and see into the true nature of the mind with a mind of alert, open inquiry, we realize that nothing's amiss. When we take the backward step and turn the mind around and allow the light of the mind to shine back on itself, when we sit in the direct experience of each moment of our lives, it just arises, just as it is. each moment its own meaning. And it's fine, just as it is. It's these emotions, though, that fuel us in our practice. The fuel that propels us to practice is our realization, for most of us, for some of us, realization of the hopelessness of trying to get ourselves happy, trying to get to some happy place by lining things up the way we want them to be. Hopelessness of following our desires and aversions as a path to happiness, this merry-go-round of desire and dissatisfaction. The inevitability of loss and separation from our loved ones. The inevitability of sickness, old age, and death, and pain. It fuels us in our aspiration to awaken. It fuels me. To see through this dissatisfied mind of mine. To see through this suffering. To see through what seems like loss and what seems like the ravages of change and impermanence. To realize this essence of mind, which is whole and complete and lacking nothing. To really taste for myself that this life is unfolding naturally, just as it needs to. Now, Zazen's a wonderful thing. Just sitting Zazen calms the mind. It's wonderful. Stills the mind. Stills these negative emotions. How wonderful just to experience a mind that's still and at peace. What a relief. But then, of course, we have to get up and enter the fray of life again, and all too often, inevitably, those negative emotions build all over again. Our task here in this session is not just to still the mind, but to see into the nature of our minds and to see through this suffering, to realize the mind ground common to us all, common to all. This mind ground, which is not of the nature to suffer, to see the truth, the mind which is completely intimate with all of the circumstances of our lives. You can't fit the thickness of a cigarette paper in between it. You can't fit a hair in between the mind and the circumstances of our life. Completely intimate, always at peace. To see through the ravages of impermanence, old age, and loss, and to realize the truth of the Dharma, which is true in all places and all times. There's a lovely poem. It goes back to the time of the Buddha, a poem of one of his students, a woman named Amrapali, who was said to be so beautiful, she wasn't allowed to marry any one man because of the fear that she would cause war in the kingdom. So she became a courtesan and ultimately realized herself very deeply. This is her poem. Black was my hair, the color of bees, and curled at the tips. But with age, it looked like coarse hemp. The truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Fragrant, like a perfume basket filled with flowers. But with age, it smelled musty, like animal fur. The truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Thick and lush, like a well-tended grove made splendid, the tips elaborate with comb and pin. With age, it grew thin and bare here and there. But the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Adorned with gold and delicate pins, it was splendid, ornamented with braids. Now with age, that head has gone bald. The truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Curved as if drawn by an artist, my brows were once splendid. With age, they drop down in folds. But the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Radiant, brilliant like jewels, my eyes. With age, they're no longer splendid. But the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Like a delicate peak, my nose was splendid in the prime of my youth. With age, it's like a long pepper. But the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Like bracelets, well-fashioned, well-finished, my ears were once splendid. With age, they drop down in folds. But the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Like plantain buds in their color, My teeth were once splendid. With age, they're broken and yellowed. But the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Like that of a cuckoo in the dense jungle, flitting through deep forest thickets, sweet was the tone of my voice. With age, it cracks here, it cracks there. But the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Smooth, like a conch shell, well polished, my neck was once splendid. With age, it's broken down and bent, but the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Like rounded door bars, both of them, my arms were once splendid. With age, they're dried up patali trees, but the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Adorned with gold and delicate rings, my hands were once splendid. With age, they're like onions and tubers, but the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Swelling, round, firm, and high. Both my breasts were once splendid. In the drought of old age, they dangle like empty old water bags. But the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Like a sheet of gold, well burnished, my body was splendid. Now it's covered with very fine wrinkles. But the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Smooth in their lines, like an elephant's trunk, both my thighs were once splendid. With age, they're like knotted bamboo. The truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Adorned with gold and delicate bracelets, my calves were once splendid. With age, they're like sesame sticks. But the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. As if they were stuffed with soft cotton, both my feet were once splendid. With age, they're shriveled and cracked. But the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. Such was this physical heap I call a body. Now, a house with its plaster all fallen off. But the truth of the Dharma doesn't change. We've been working in this session with the teachings of the Buddha from an ancient teaching text called the Sutra of Complete Enlightenment. An assembly of deeply enlightened bodhisattvas questions the Buddha about the essence of the practice of enlightenment, practice of liberation, of freedom, the essence of Zen practice. What is this essence? The practice of a clear mind. Just to see directly into the true self of things, alertly see through our delusion and see what's true right now. Drop off body and mind. What does that mean? I have a friend who says that for years he was galvanized in his practice by the sense that there was a glass wall between him and his experience. Tear down the wall, my friends. See that there's never been a wall there. We see ourselves as alive inside these bodies. We see ourselves that there's a me inside of here. There's a me on this side of my eyes, on this side of the wall. We understand our thoughts and feelings and plans and intentions and memories to be the activity of this me. I'm thinking, I'm sad, I'm going to go to the movie. Practice in this session is to see through this ordinary, everyday view of things, to see what's really true, to see for directly for ourselves this truth of the Dharma that doesn't change. To do this practice requires concentration. It requires that we diligently take up the practice, that we meditate diligently and stabilize the mind, so it's still like the pool of water in the forest. But this practice isn't a developmental activity. It isn't a matter of gradual growth or development. As I've said, it isn't a seed that you water and that grows over time. It isn't something that has to be built up or evolved or developed in future. It's manifesting right here and now, this moment of your lives. The color of the floor. It's that which sees the floor. It looks through the eyes and it looks at the eyes. It's this present moment. It's these circumstances of your life that you experience, you say you experience, feels like we experience as outside, as well as everything that's inside. We all come to this practice through faith in reliance on what we've read or heard, the promise of liberation, the promise of freedom. And it requires faith to accept those promises that someone isn't just selling snake oil. I remember in the early days of my practice reading the old masters and going looking at these texts and saying, Man, oh man, these guys, you wouldn't spend the time writing this down just to bamboozle somebody. Also requires faith in our own Buddha nature. Faith that as others have realized themselves, so can I. It requires faith in the teaching. It requires faith in the teachers. It's important to recognize, in truth, a teacher can't give you one damn thing. I wish he could. I really, really wish they could, but they can't give you anything. They give you some instruction in the method. They can give you one of the greatest things. I look to Hogen and Chosen Roshi for is exemplars. I look to them for their presence. I look to them as a true mirror that they hold up to me that I can look into. But in truth, they can only show us a door. Each one of us has to find our own way in. Especially, it requires trust in the practice. No matter what arises, no matter what torment arises in your mind, no matter what frustration, return to the practice. No matter what great insight you've had, oh, I've seen into the truth of Western philosophy. I've seen the answer to what's been plaguing mankind forever. Just go back to the practice. Requires steady, unremitting practice. If you want to ignite your practice, it's like rubbing two sticks together, Hakuin Zenji said. Rubbing two sticks together, if you rub long enough, eventually they'll get hot and they'll ignite. But if you rub for a while and then you stop and you say, you know, I think I'll have a latte, you know, and then you go back, you start all over again. Just so with our practice. Returning over and over again to the mind ground. Dogen Zenji says this determination is like a thin thread of water dripping on rock that over time drips through. But there's another quality to this determination that's so important, and that's bounce back. That's bounce back. Everybody here has been knocked down, been knocked back in their practice. It's just how it is. The stronger your resolve, the more pushback you're going to get in the practice. And you've got to bounce back. It's a practice of resilience. Down seven times, up eight. It's just how it is. But perhaps the most essential to Sesshin practice is that we raise up a great question into our minds as to what the truth of life is. I say a great question, but it isn't the kind of a question that is a verbal question. It's a kind of question that doesn't go any farther than, huh. It's just like, huh. As soon as these words start coming up and you start asking yourself verbal questions, this verbal insight that we're all so inclined to bring forward just isn't a lot of help, quite frankly. You just get caught on the ideas. We have to use words. But be careful that you don't get caught on the ideas. The mind that you require in Zazen is not the mind of knowing, not the mind of figuring out, not the mind of, oh, I can answer that question and bring it into Sanzen. It's the mind of not knowing. Huh. Life's truly a mystery, but we sleepwalk through our lives so much of the time, locked in our little narrow view of things, our personal dramas, round and round, trying to get ourselves happy, trying to get our lives the way we want them to be. Most of the time, I think I'm not even aware that I'm confused. We're so busy with the real world a lot of the time that it's hard to even find time for our spiritual practice. All of the business of our lives. And we're pretty confident we know what the real world is. We know where the rubber hits the road. Work, family, government. This world that we see ourselves as being born into, that existed before us, that continues after us, this objective reality. It's an auspicious event, my friends, when a burning question about the mystery of life takes hold in your mind. What am I? Huh. What's this? Huh. Where does it come from? Huh. What is it that's born and dies? What is it that was never born and will never die? These questions push us out of our complacency. Or obsession with gaining and losing and trying to get ourselves satisfied. Sometimes a question arises out of our suffering, loss of a loved one, by death or divorce, a near-death experience ourselves or some other intense experience, perhaps out of fear of death, perhaps out of fear of life. Sometimes a question arises from a sense of amazement and wonder at the mystery of life, or from a sense of horror and confusion as to why there's so much suffering in the world, why there's cruelty and evil. It's another poem by William Blake. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of your eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain? In what furnace was forged thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did God smile his work to see? Did the God who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? There's an old story from Tibet about awakening to this mystery of life, what happens when you look deeply into the still forest pool of the mind, this pool, this mystery out of which everything arises and to which it returns. A long time ago in India, there was a great king. He was getting older, and he trained his son in all the ways of great kings to rule after him, all the ways of power, how to rule, how to enjoy court life, all of the pleasures of being king. The queen mother questioned the wisdom of such a completely worldly life, though, and she tried to direct her son to the practice of Dharma, but he'd have none of it. He happily enjoyed the rich court life. Not knowing what to do, the queen sought the advice of her sorcerer. He asked her, "What does your son enjoy most in all of the world?" "Horses," said the queen. "He's passionate about horses. It's horses he cares most for." The magician said, "That'll do," and he told the queen to walk in the garden with her son the next afternoon. The next day, just after lunch, the queen asked her son and the court retinue to stroll with her in the palace gardens. At the end of the garden, just outside the gate, stood a magnificent white stallion. An old man held the reins, and the prince ran up to the horse and examined it, and then approached the old man. He said, "This is a magnificent horse. I have to have it. How much do you want for it?" The old man bowed and said, "Not so fast, please. You're a powerful prince. I'd be foolish to sell it to you until you'd at least ridden it. Mount up. Take it for a ride. If you still want the horse when you return, we can discuss price." The prince needed no urging. He mounted. As soon as he was in the saddle, the horse started to gallop so fast. Faster and faster they raced through the town and out into the surrounding countryside. The prince was thrilled. He'd never ridden such a horse. They galloped over the hills and through the mountains and into the next kingdom without stopping. The horse never tired. They galloped far beyond any villages or towns into regions that the prince had never been before and didn't know. Finally, as the sun began to set, the horse slowed to a walk and then stopped in the middle of a deep forest. The prince looked around. He had no idea where he was. He dismounted and led the horse along the path. Evening was coming, and he was a little worried about being lost in the forest and what might befall him. But then he saw a light in the distance and went towards it, and the light came from a small cottage. He knocked on the door, and a beautiful young woman answered. The prince explained his plight, but she'd never heard of his kingdom. Still, night had fallen, so she invited the prince in and introduced him to her father, an old man who worked as a woodcutter. The prince stayed the night and set out the next morning to find his way home. He traveled as far as he could and asked every person he met about his home kingdom, but no one knew anything about it or how to help him find his way home. Each night, the prince returned to the woodcutter and his daughter. Eventually, he began to help the old man with his work. He learned how to cut wood, and he grew wise in the ways of the forest. The prince was increasingly attracted to the daughter, and she to him, so they married. The prince settled down to his new life and his new trade. Occasionally, when he saw the horse by the house, he remembered how he'd come there, but he didn't dwell on the matter long. In time, his wife gave birth to a son and a daughter. His life was full. The old man retired, and the prince took over the business. He cut wood, stacked it, took it to market. Didn't make a lot, didn't have a lot of income, but it took care of their needs. They lived frugally, they had a few other cares, so they lived happily and peacefully. The memories of his former life as a prince faded away. The prince often walked in the forest. On one of his walks, he came to a clearing in the forest he hadn't seen before. And in the clearing was a pond with water so clear and still, you could see all the way to the bottom. The meadow, clearing in the forest, rather, the pond and the still, clear water drew him for reasons he couldn't understand. He went often to the pond and would sit and look down into its still depths. One day, while he sat by the pond, he heard a cry. His two children came running out of the forest. A tiger was chasing them. He had never seen a tiger in the forest before. The prince jumped up to protect his children, but before he could do anything, his children ran into the pond and disappeared. The tiger jumped into the pond and disappeared as well. Then his wife came running up, and she ran in after them. She also disappeared. The old man came hobbling along and followed the others, and he too disappeared into the water. At that moment, the prince's horse galloped up, leaped into the center of the pond, and disappeared. The waters of the pond became still and clear again. But there was no trace of his family, or the horse, or the tiger. The prince was dumbfounded. What had happened? In the space of 2 minutes, everything in his life had vanished. Unable to take in what had happened, he continued to look in the water, hoping to see something. When the shock of his loss finally hit him, he fell to the ground, his body shaking with sobs, and he cried and he cried. And he felt a hand softly touching his shoulder, and he looked up. Above him were the eyes of his mother, the queen, and around him were the concerned faces of the court retainers, the palace guards, and the horse standing quietly. The queen told him he'd fallen off the horse and hit his head when he tried to mount it, and he'd been lying in a trance for 2 or 3 minutes. "No," said the prince, "not 2 or 3 minutes, years. I had a life, I had a family, a trade, people I loved, a wife and children. I had things that mattered to me. I lived my whole life. It wasn't 2 or 3 minutes. That is impossible." Dazed and bewildered, he stood and walked away. The old man bowed to the queen, took the horse, and left. The prince was profoundly moved by this experience, by this mystery, and his attitude changed. His heart opened every moment of his life. After his father died, the prince ruled wisely and well, fully present and attentive to the concerns of his people and the welfare of his kingdom. Now you may say, life is real and a dream's a dream. And that's true. Life's a real dream. But what's common to both is the mind. None of this experience arises outside the mind. When we're dreaming, it seems just as real as waking life, more real sometimes. We don't know we're dreaming. Whole tableaus are enacted. Time passes. We live in relationship. People come into our lives, pass out of our lives in the dream, maybe elated, terrified. But then our partner wakes us up. "Oh, you're only asleep for a few moments." This present moment is timeless. "See infinity in a grain of sand and eternity in an hour," says Blake. This boundless mind, big mind, Suzuki Roshi called it, is timeless. It's outside time. One of our chants says, "One instant is 10,000 years. Time is completely relative in our lived experience of life. An hour in conversation with someone you care for passes in an instant. An hour sitting zazen with Your aching knees can seem like an eternity. In this waking life, we experience ourselves as living this life. Whole tableaus are enacted. Time passes. People come into and pass out of our lives. Returning to that still pool of water. Where does it all come from, instant by instant? What's that still pool of water where it returns to? We can't know where it comes from, and we can't know where it goes. All we can know is life. All we can know is this moment of our life. We can't know death. It's a mystery. When you look directly, though, at your own experience of this moment, how do you distinguish between your lived experience of this moment and the dream you had last night? Last night you experienced yourself living all of those events in your dream, but now you say, oh, it's only my mind. I was in my dream, I was doing all those things, but no, it was just my mind. When you look directly, not with the thinking mind, not with the mind of memory, but with the eye of awareness, is there anything in the direct experience of the present moment to your life that arises outside of your awareness? All just arising in your mind, big mind. All of reality arising in the mind, returning to the mind. This big mind, no more or less reality than a dream, different kind of dream. The great Xuanzi has this famous little poem. He said, once upon a time, I dreamed that I was a butterfly, flying about enjoying myself. And it didn't know it was Xuanzi. Suddenly I woke up, and I was Xuanzi. Now I don't know whether I'm Xuanzi dreaming I was a butterfly, or whether it was a butterfly dreaming that I'm Xuanzi. Look into this still forest pool, my friends. Open to this mystery. Practice with a mind of not knowing. Let go of what you think you know, what you think you've seen. Let go of your rational mind and look at things directly for the first time. Open to the mystery of this present moment. It isn't something to be solved. It's the living of your life. Look directly. Please practice diligently, my friend.